is most of the world at a state where growth has ceased to be important for achieving human well-being? And the answer is no, like nowhere near, nowhere near.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, many development economists would argue that the most important innovation of the last two decades has been a commitment to use only rigorous evidence for policy. And usually what they mean by that is evidence generated by RCTs or natural experiments. So most weeks on Vox Dev Talks, we end up discussing external validity, which is, of course, how to interpret these experimental results in other contexts. But when we combine or average these results, is this a useful guide to policy? And should development economics be focusing so much on the programs that flow from this particular type of research and insight? Lant Pritchett of, well, it's the London School of Economics now, Lant, isn't it? Is someone who has opinions about this. He joins me now. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, Lant.
Thanks for inviting me.
Lant, is your argument that we should never be relying on the rigorous evidence, or is it that we might be interpreting these results in the wrong way?
I think I would never make you argue that you shouldn't rely somewhat, or you shouldn't include the rigorous evidence in your overall understanding of your policymaking and the phenomena that you're addressing and how you understand cause and effect. Mm-hmm. But the advice that you should rely only on rigorous evidence or exclusively on rigorous evidence or excessively on rigorous evidence is completely, totally false. So the claims being made that this rigorous evidence should be given some super special priority in policy formulation and project design is just completely empirically untenable. Mm-hmm. It's just not true. Let me say what the heart of the paper we're talking about is, which is, there's a pretty simple question. I'm sitting in country X, Zambia, mm-hmm. Egypt, Nepal, and I have an old-fashioned OLS estimate of the association between some policy or impact parameter I might be interested in and outcomes. Mm-hmm. So old-fashioned multivariate OLS. And then people have done in other places a bunch of experiments, and they've done a process called a systematic review, which is identify all of the world's available, rigorously identified causal estimates. The question is, would I get a better prediction error of what would happen if I did it in my country, if I relied on my old-fashioned OLS, or if I relied on the average of the rigorous estimates from the systematic review? Mm-hmm.
And as you point out, there are a lot of these reviews at the moment creating these averages.
Exactly. Lots of people are funding both the experiments to create the content for the systematic reviews and the systematic reviews. And lots of people are writing papers about various domains of policymaking based on that you should rely for your judgment about what to do on this synthesis of the rigorous estimates of causal impact. Now, the answer to the question of should I rely on my homegrown but naive estimate mm-hmm. or a sophisticated systematic review depends on the variance across contexts and what I'm measuring. So a simple example I use in the paper is suppose I want to give men a pair of pants.
Okay.
And I want the pair of pants to fit. Mm-hmm. Well, suppose also that men lie about their height and they say they're taller than they really are.
They do.
And then the man's self-reported height is a biased estimate of their true height. So I have one problem, which is I have a bias. And then I do a rigorous study of actual men's heights, and I could recover the mean and distribution of the true heights in the relevant population. Then the question is, what if I assigned every man the true average and so got rid of the self-report bias
right.
by just forcing every man to accept the average pant size, which would give me larger prediction error? Well, it obviously depends on the relative magnitude of the lies men tell and the true variance across men and heights. Illustratively, the variation across men and heights is huge relative to the lie they tell because, you know, You can't say you're 6'4 if you're 5'10. People just look at you like, well, I'm not stupid. I know that's not true. So what I did in this paper is I took two examples of places where we now have a large number across countries of estimates of the raw difference, mm-hmm. what the estimated OLL difference, and a plausible causally identified difference that corrects increasingly, and the move of the first corrects for observed selection bias. So take the example of, is a kid going to learn more in private schools
right.
than public schools? Okay.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
First of all, I can just estimate the difference between learning of a typical kid in a private and public school. We all know that that's biased because richer or maybe intellectually more adept kids ends up selecting into private school. So we all know that's biased. So yeah. Then we can correct for the observable bias using standard statistical techniques to say, well, let's control for how rich the kid is, or let's control for other things. The essence of the enthusiasm for RCTs is that observational methods leave out the unobservable bias. So what I do in this paper is I say, look, let's take where we have cross-country estimates of the raw, the OLS, and of the true observable and unobservable bias selection causal impact. And then I can just run this horse race. I can say, would you have had a more accurate prediction of the learning gain of a child from being in private versus public school from your regular OLS estimate or from the average of the true causal estimates? And the answer is, you would be much better off using your homegrown OLS estimate for all its flaws and admitting that it's an inconsistent and has bias for the true, because you haven't corrected for the unobserved. But the error of the unobserved is smaller by a lot than the true variance across countries. So in the end, all of the doing experiments, all of the doing a systematic review to say what is the average of the gain of a typical child where it's been studied rigorously with an RCT or natural experiment, all of that is less useful to you. And if you relied only on the rigorous evidence, you would get a larger predicted error on average of what you would get from just relying on your homegrown, completely naive OLS. This should be really shocking.
It is a bit, because you're not saying either that we just haven't done enough experiments yet. You're saying that we'll just never get there.
Well, we'll never get there because, after all, like the example with the pants, as we get a larger and larger sample, we get a more accurate mean, but we also just replicate the variance. So when you look at the variance of the, you know, plausibly causally identified estimates, that variance is big. And then the question is, what do I do with that variance? So say I take this array of estimates of the impact of putting a kid in private school versus public school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I know across the multiple experiences we have large variance. Well, then what estimate do I use? Well, I still am tempted to use the mean, but then the question is, if the variance of the causal estimates is big, I know using the mean is on average going to give me a big error by exactly the distribution. Whereas my own OLS estimate tells me a lot more about where I'm likely to be in the distribution of the causal estimates. Let me just take a really concrete example.
Yeah.
Indonesia. I've lived in Indonesia, worked in Indonesia, so I like Indonesia as an example. And in this case, it's perfect because if you look at the OLS estimate of the difference between private and public students in Indonesia, it's not a big gain.
Right.
And the reason it's not a big gain is by tradition, the public secondary schools were highly selective. So the best schools in Indonesia are the test score selective public schools.
Right.
And the private market serves, prosaically, the rich but dumb kids. And then the lowest quality public schools serve the non-test adept kids. And so the market is already stratified such that the selection effect of taking a kid from a random public school and putting him in a random private school isn't to improve the quality of their schooling. So I kind of know how Indonesia works. And in the data, this is exactly what happens. All that I just said about stratification in the market, that's not from rigorous evidence. That's just from observation and understanding how the market works and some OLS. And if I use the average of the rigorous estimates for private schools, it would tell me the impact of private school on learning is much more positive than it really is in Indonesia. So ignoring my understanding of Indonesia and the empirical basis of that understanding in favor of a systematic review of the rigorous evidence would lead me to a larger prediction error. Indonesia's OLS, it's really telling me real information about Indonesia, and I shouldn't ignore that.
Land, when I speak to your colleagues week after week, and they have done this rigorous research, they are very conservative about how they would interpret that in other contexts. And also, if you have policymakers in Indonesia, they would know what you know about Indonesia's schools. So are there real mistakes being made here?
I think there are real mistakes being made, because the first mistake is there's no way to justify the being super conservative about the external validity of your results and spending the enormous amount of time, attention, and talent on the RCT. You can't have it both ways. You can't say we're going to devote the best and brightest of development economics to doing a study in one particular context and then say, oh, by the way, this doesn't apply to anywhere else, and you can't use it for anything other than exactly the context in which it was done. And RCTs are just amazingly more expensive than other forms of research, right? And by the way, we're sucking the best and brightest from economics into it. They've been having it both ways. So the first mistake we're making is spending way too much time, talent, and resources on rigorous evidence if we don't believe in external validity. You can't have it both ways. Second, I do think there is a lot of mimicry across countries where countries are like, wow, I don't know, what we're being told by the rest of the world and the elites of economics is that these programs work. And the contextual information is in countries where the policymaking apparatus feels both intellectually and financially weak. Yeah, there are mistakes being made because people are going along with ideas that are being propagated from evidence from other places. Yeah, I think there are.
So, Lance, I want to discuss with you whether there is a bigger implication here. If you think there is a misallocation of resources in development economics research, if you think that maybe development economics has taken a wrong turn, what is being neglected?
I think that what development meant was national development. In the aftermath of World War II, countries emerged from colonialization and they were new nation states. And what we thought, I mean, I wasn't super engaged, I would have been 2 years old, but what generally was thought is if these nation states become more developed nation states, that will naturally, through a series of causal processes, lead human beings to be better off. And I think the process of national development was broadly get a more productive economy. So as a crude, but not entirely terrible measure, GDP per capita should be higher. You should get a more benign government. Now that you've rid yourself of your colonial taskmasters, you should have some way in which the government is accountable and responsive to the needs of their people. You should get a more capable state. So you have organizations in the public sector that accomplish what they set out to do. If you set out to collect taxes, you actually collect taxes. If you set out to educate children, you educate children. And development is set of common equality of treatment of everyone on an equal basis, generally under the law, meaning get rid of kith and clan as primary determinants of what happens to you in public settings. That was what we meant. The goal of that was that the newly independent countries would become full and equal players in the global scheme. That was what development was. There has always been a tension between that vision of development and the vision of development as mitigating the consequences of the lack of national development. Okay, yeah, that's the long run vision. But in the short run, we have these kids not in school. We have kids not getting vaccinations. We lack these things, and we need programmatic attention to mitigate the human development consequences of the lack of national development. That tension runs through development economics since it became a field in the late 50s, early 60s. I feel what happened was the general thinking slid to a very narrow, very low bar interpretation of mitigating the consequences of the lack of national development. like dollar-a-day poverty. Reframe the development challenge not as national development, that India becomes Great Britain, that Senegal becomes France, what Fukuyama calls getting to Denmark, and let's just go for mitigating the consequences of the fact that Bolivia isn't Denmark now. Look at the Millennium Development Goals. This was a complete re-envisioning of what development meant to very low bar, very narrow targets on the premise that these were programmatically achievable things.
Mm-hmm.
So we slid away from national development towards programmatic approaches to mitigating the consequences of national development on the worst off. Both of those are good things, but we got to slide way back towards national development for two reasons. One, in the end, I have a paper called National Development Delivers that just says, look, if we take these crude measures of national development, nearly all of the variation in human well-being on any measure is correlated with that. It is the case that if you get to Denmark, you get to Denmark levels of well-being. And if you don't, you don't. If all you're doing is mitigating and not actually developing, you're never going to get to where you want to get to. So the kind of anti-poverty programs that aim at these super low bar poverty levels, they're not the story. The programmatic effects on poverty are inconsequential compared to the national development effects on poverty. If you want these human well-being objectives, you can't accomplish them without national development. I am part of I'm part of an effort to slide development back from being the playground of billionaires who want to do effective charity to actually focusing on the needs of governments and people in developing countries.
But Lan, no one has ever stopped focusing on macroeconomic growth. There are thousands of economists working really hard to do it. Is development economics not a big enough tent that it can combine both flavors?
No, it's not. They've driven people like me out of the tent. I'm serious. I think your statement has truth in it, but let's parse it out. Take the field of development as having three main actors. One is development institutions like FCDO, like the World Bank, like the African Development Bank, and include in that philanthropists. Then you take academic development economics. And then you take national governments and national researchers, not the global elite researchers, but people working in Zambia or in Nepal. And Arvind Subramanian, he'd been chief economist of India for 2 years, and he said, look, the idea that growth isn't the focus of the development is talking about development institutions and development academics. That's all governments are still worried about. So you're right. The people in developing countries, both policymakers, politicians, and people generally, they're still mainly worried about the big picture vision of development. They still want to be full and equal players on the global scale. They've never accepted this vision of low bar goals as being the objective of development. But then secondly, I just disbelieve your claim that that characterizes current development economics at the elite level. It's just dominated by people answering tiny questions.
If we're looking at macroeconomic growth, how can we decide whether that growth is serving the needs of the people that we care about most, that it is, in the jargon we use, pro-poor?
Well, yes, that's an amazingly important question. And that's why I've written several papers about exactly that question in the last 3 years. And I can't get any of those papers even read. So first of all, name the 10 papers about that question in the last 5 years.
I can't.
Exactly. I am writing those papers, and I think those papers are speaking to the fact that growth and its pro-poorness are, in fact, the essential feature of accomplishing nearly every human well-being objective. But those aren't for my own amusement.
I have read those papers, so I know the answer to what I'm going to ask you. Is there a way, rigorously, to be able to say, here is how growth is working in producing the outcomes that we care about, which may not be measured in financial terms?
Depends on what you mean by rigorous. right? Is there a way to show this in an empirically convincing way?
Willing
to be empirically convinced? Yes. On the other hand, I have heard people say the words non-randomized evidence are an oxymoron.
Right.
Is it persuasive to a reasonable individual who has a reasonable Bayesian approach to the world? Yes, I think it is. What I'm working on is exactly showing what's the elasticity of growth with respect to human well-being indicators we care about, and how is that affected by the inequality in the growth? How is that affected by the capability of the state? And how is that affected by your level of income? I'm super happy to believe that growth gets less important as you get richer. And I can show that that's true in the data for a lot of things we care about. But the question is most of the world at a state where growth has ceased to be important for achieving human well-being? And the answer, again, on a rigorous level is no, like nowhere near. There are still super important gains to material well-being of the type we care about, even for upper middle income countries, from just the growth that they are experiencing. And again, all of this takes into account that the more of the growth that happens for the less advantage in the economy, the better it is. But even taking that into account, just on average, growth is good.
And I guess in the next few years, we are facing some huge global problems, geopolitical problems, climate problems. Will that maybe force the discourse on this back towards this bigger picture that you're talking about?
I think the geopolitics is forcing this back onto the agenda because the countries in the world that are becoming more powerful, like India and like China and like others, in a more fractured, less unipolar world, are just rejecting the vision of development that was the low bar kind of Western aid development institution and academic program. And they're saying, look, we want what you have. I think, for instance, on the poverty line stuff, the dollar to poverty is going to be gone as a relevant indicator in the next year or two because it's become so completely irrelevant to the interests and concerns of the powerful governments of the global South. So I think the relative shift of power towards the global South is changing the global discourse about the importance of growth because they're just like, look, if you're not on board with this in promoting an environment for growth, you're not really speaking to our concerns, and in a perfectly legitimate democratic way. This isn't authoritarian governments I'm talking about. This is India, you know, functional democracy. But climate is the big spoiler because there's a significant fraction of the global West that sees economic growth in the South as a threat to climate change. And that's just conflictual. And so more emphasis on climate isn't necessarily going to lead to a reasonable view of what needs to happen on growth because, you know, there are voices in the West that want to say they're poor but happy. They don't really want all this material burden that we in the West have accumulated. They're happy to say complete bullshit to reconcile the view that they're really concerned about climate change, but they don't want other people to have economic growth.
Lance, if you were just starting out on your career, and you were an ambitious, young development economist, and you wanted to do good in the world, what would you choose to focus on now?
I think there's two big issues there. One is that countries in the world have managed to create economic growth in a way that's not conducive to long-term growth. Mm-hmm. That's a super big issue. We can celebrate the fact that since the 1990s, actually, the growth in developing countries has been faster than growth in the OECD. And so we are experiencing now absolute convergence in a way that we weren't and hadn't been for 100 years. But, and I'm just working on this issue right now. So when you say, well, what would I do if I'm young? I'm still young at heart, maybe, because I'm going to say that if you were young and ambitious, you should work on what I'm working on right now, which is kind of you should expect from an academic.
But I didn't mean to imply anything.
But the issue is we've had lots of rapid growth experiences, which didn't lead to broader development. The politics didn't get better. The administrative capability didn't get better, and the laws and regulations didn't get better. You just develop better mechanisms to achieve economic growth without doing any of those things. Bangladesh is an enormously important case in point. For a long time, people say, oh, look at Bangladesh. There's a Bangladesh miracle. It's having rapid growth. And neener, neener, it's not doing any of that good institution stuff you said was important. And then that ends up in a revolution. Mm-hmm. Because sooner or later, the underlying foundations of that growth erode. Okay, yes, we want to generate growth, but we want to generate growth in a way that is truly inclusive economically, that is consistent with rule of law, and which is consistent with true political inclusion. How to do that is a super hard question. I thought 30 years ago, the hard question is, how do we generate growth? Well, it turns out lots of the answers to the question, how do we generate growth, aren't also answers to how do we do it in a politically inclusive, rule of law consistent and sustained way. That's a big question. Second thing I would be worried about is, broadly taken, just state capability. There was a study a while back, and I'm not claiming this is representative of all of India or all of the world, but, you know, India has this huge public sector supported chain of direct publicly provided healthcare. And they did a study in a rural area of one of the states of India and found that the best first responder medical care and the worst medical care were exactly the same people.
Oh.
So the public sector doctors in their public sector clinics gave substantially worse care than the very unregulated and very low quality private sector, which often meant just going to a pharmacist and say, what do I take? Because my back hurts, mm-hmm. You know, completely unqualified providers. But the best care was those exact same people in their private practices. So that's just one of thousands of examples of the way in which the real limit on the efficacy of the programmatic attempts to improve human well-being is the capability of the public sector organizations expected to implement it. And if we don't know or aren't working on the question of how do we work to make those public sector organizations better at accomplishing the objectives that are set out for them and implementing with fidelity and impact even the ideal designs that might in principle be part of what works, then we're not working on the big issue. Sustained, inclusive growth and state capability of organizations to implement with fidelity and effectiveness are the two big intellectual challenges of the next 30 years.
I'm looking forward to quite a lot more of your work on this in the next few years.
Well, because I'm young and ambitious.
Thank you very much for talking about this to me today.
Thank you.
The paper we were talking about at the beginning, Rely Only on the Rigorous Evidence is Bad Advice, is the title, and that was published in the Review of Development Economics 2024. That's open access, so anyone can read it. National Development Delivers, that was published in Economic Modeling, volume 107, that was in 2022. Randomizing Development, Method or Madness, and that was published in a volume called Randomized Controlled Trials in the Field of Development, A Critical Perspective, 2020. Lance, is there anything else that I should be mentioning?
Only future work that's in the pipeline.
We'll be looking out for that. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. And the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes are at voxdev.org. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and tell someone else about us.